This is Christoph Kisun, and you're listening to Navigating Diversity, where we explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. Today, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. You're going to be hearing my voice and my voice alone, and I'm going to be sharing some of my thoughts and feelings and perspectives on what is going on in the country politically right now. We're in the last leg of a very important election on November 3rd of 2020, which is just a few weeks away, y'all. We are going to elect the next president and vice president of the United States for the next 4 years, as well as the US Senate. So this is a pretty big one, and this is the first year of a global pandemic where we've had to sort of rethink a lot of the way we've been living, not only in the United States, but globally. I don't know how you guys are feeling, but things are very tense these days. I think as we get closer to the election, everybody's just kind of taking like a big breath, and we're all just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, because who knows what could potentially transpire in the next few months as people's anxiety starts spiking and people start getting more violent and more frustrated depending on how the election goes or doesn't go. So I'm concerned, and I feel like I would be doing a huge injustice to myself if I didn't take this opportunity to kind of share my truth and find a way to make people understand what's at stake. So let's talk about voting. My sense has been increasingly within the past month, seeing discourse on social media and on Facebook and just in general, there are people out there who are listening to me right now, and you've already made up your mind that you're not going to vote. And let me tell you why that's very, very problematic. In the United States of America, it is a privilege to vote. Do not get it twisted. Do not think that just because you have the ability to vote means that everybody else does. There are hundreds of thousands of people in this country that do not have the right to vote, and there are hundreds of thousands of people who might have the right to vote, but do not have access to voting. For example, just because you can make it to a polling station, or you have the means and the transportation, you get the time off from your job to actually go and vote and still get paid for the time that you were gone, because there are people living dollar to dollar and even missing 2 hours of work to go get a polling station and back is not a reality for them. The system is designed in such a way that it is not easy for people who have been marginalized and oppressed to vote. And then let's talk about the people who have neither the right to vote nor the access. Let's talk about immigrants in this country. People who have paid all their taxes, because yes, contrary to what you might believe, immigrants do pay taxes, we have to, get no power and get no weight in political decision making, unless the people who do have full political rights in this country make decisions based on our behalf and in our best interest. So when I see people saying things like, oh, I'm not going to go vote because I don't like either party, or I don't like either candidate, right? Or the system is all just so terrible and I'm not going to participate. You are throwing away your privilege by not making a choice. Yes, you have a choice. No matter how frustrated you might be with the system and how things are going, at least you have a choice. At least you have a little bit of democratic power still. You have a little tiny stake in the government. What about people who don't? And it's the people who don't even have that tiny little stake that are often affected the most. by government policies. It's the people on the margins of society and who can't participate in the system, who get excluded even more, who get exploited and abused and thrown in detention centers. So that is not an argument. You have to be able to make a choice. Even on the vice presidential debate that took place on October 7th of 2020, even a fly picked, even a fly had a preference. So to think that you actually have a choice between voting and not voting is a privilege. And the only way you can even think that way is because you probably have never been affected by what the government does. If it's only ever ruled in your favor and it's only ever done more and more things to prop you up and support you and support your community and your little ideology, then why would you even feel the need to change anything or feel the need to participate? You're just taking everything for granted. If you had been through anything near what marginalized populations and minorities have been through across generations, you would know that you had a choice and that you should use it. Not just for yourself, but for other people. The next concept I kind of want to talk about is racism. I don't know if we can talk about the election and politics without talking about racism. But I want to pay particular attention to internalized racism. There are lots of people of color in this country who have made it, right? They've assimilated, they've been relatively successful, I suppose, compared to other members of their racial or ethnic or cultural community. And they are racist towards their own people. They have adopted this white Eurocentric narrative, this story that they come from a community that is inferior and they were the exception. It was through their hard work and their subscription to American values and pulling themselves by their bootstraps and making themselves more white that somehow they were able to overcome what was biologically, naturally wrong with them in the first place. So they are effectively accepting the whole premise of the argument of racism. So when I see people of color voting for racist policies and voting for racist candidates, it's shocking. And it really shows how short institutional memory is, how quickly we tend to forget what it is like to suffer, what it is like to have the knee on your throat. And this is all part of a much bigger conversation about separateness, not just within POC communities, but within all of humanity. For some reason, we keep still seeing ourselves as separate from other people. And we keep thinking that what is happening to them will not happen to us. But what makes you so special? What makes you so invincible? What makes you think that when they're done with them, they won't come for you next? Suffering anywhere is suffering everywhere. No man is free until all men are free. That's what Dr. King said. And I don't know if it could be any more apparent than it is in 2020. Because I think a lot of people all around the world, it hasn't quite hit them yet that this is a pandemic. Pan means all hands on deck. Everybody is at stake. The only way out is through, and the only way out is together. All of us. So this should be a huge unifying moment for us, where we can come together and let our ego down for 2 minutes and have a little bit of empathy for what people are going through. Because that could have very easily been you if the lottery had gone differently and you got a different set of genes and a different set of circumstances to be born into and grew up in. That could have been you in the detention center. That could have been you in the refugee camp. It could have been you who was born queer instead of your child and had to navigate the world with everybody telling you that something was wrong with you. If you can't see the equality of all human beings yet and start making political choices, making decisions and taking political action to make that equality real, to institutionalize it throughout our government and throughout our country, particularly at a time when so much is at stake, then I don't know what it will take to wake you up. Are you going to wait for COVID to reach your doorstep? Are you going to wait until you lose somebody that you love and you care about before you start taking it seriously and realizing that all of us are in this together? And that being silent and inactive is actually a form of expression and not a very good one. You know, this is the whole premise of Dr. Bram Kendi's work, How to Be an Anti-Racist, that there's no such thing as not racist. Either you're racist or you're an anti-racist. Either you're actively promoting or supporting or propping up racist policies and policies that produce inequality generally, or you're actively working against it. This is not something that you can be neutral about. Just like with people who choose not to vote, this is not something that you can be neutral about. Because whether you make a choice for yourself and take advantage of your agency and the rights that other people have fought for you to have today, or you let that go to waste and you don't make a choice, there are still going to be consequences to that decision. And it is still going to come back to affect you and affect other people. And this might sound a little bit harsh to some people, but if you are not policing your own community and you are not calling them out when they step out of line and do things that actively endanger physically, mentally, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually minorities, then you are part of the problem. And how are you not just as bad as them? Because yeah, you might not be the one stringing people up by trees, right? But if you're not policing the people in your community who are doing that, then who's going to stop them? What is your role? How is your inaction permitted these horrific actions that people are taking today and have taken for the greater proportion of American history? If you are enabling the conditions for white supremacy to thrive, how are you not a white supremacist? If you are enabling the conditions for racism and inequality and the destruction of the environment to go unchecked, how are you not responsible? If you are not willing to have difficult and uncomfortable conversations with the people you love instead of just letting more microaggressions and more vitriol pass at the dinner table, how are you not complicit? I believe it was Gloria Steinem who, in an interview, once said, she was asked, what is the root of racism? And she said, well, sexism. And here's her argument. If you can produce inequality in the most intimate, private sphere of your life, your home, your own bedroom, if you can create and reinforce power structures there, what is stopping you from stepping outside of your house and reinforcing those same power structures onto other people in even more destructive ways? This is Christoph Kassoun, and if you're just joining us, you're listening to Navigating Diversity. So how did we get to this point where we see ourselves as so separate? How did we get to this point where we are so polarized? Well, a lot of it has to do with how we process information. Let me explain four core principles that we use in political science to explain how information processing leads to prejudice and bias and discrimination. So the first one is cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is where each and every one of us sort of has our own predispositions and our own pre-knowledge about a situation, right? A set of beliefs and ideas that I've been given my whole life to think about something. One day, I put on the news or I see something on Facebook and it's an alternate set of facts, information that does not automatically go hand in hand with what it is I think I know about the problem. I go through some discomfort because here I am being presented with something that totally goes against what I think I know. So I freak out a little bit. Research shows that a lot of us, to resolve that cognitive dissonance and to close that cognitive gap, we partake in the second concept, confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is where to reconcile these alternative opposing facts, we come up with a new theory, a third alternative explanation that can allow us to hold both. So for instance, let's say cancel culture real quick, right? Let's say somebody you love and care about a lot and you've looked up to your whole life suddenly gets canceled. Your first instinct is going to be to defend them, to protect them, because you don't want to accept the fact yet that that person is a bad person. So you make excuses. You come up with a third alternative theory and you say something like, oh, that's not exactly how they feel. It was just misinterpreted. Or look at these other great things that they're doing. They're donating to X and Y charity. I care about that purpose. I care about that philanthropy. So that should make up for any little thing that they said. They're still a good person. So I don't necessarily need to police them and hold them accountable. The third concept is selective perception. This happens a lot with media packaging. We're given a package of information. Every advertisement, every news clip, every newscast, it's a package of signals. And we selectively perceive within that package only the things that confirm our prejudices. So you're blatantly, subconsciously, and happens consciously too, ignoring all of the other information and the other signals and the other cues in the package that do matter and can give you a more balanced perspective. You only perceive what you want to perceive. You only focus on and pay attention what it is you want to focus on. So when people are watching things like the debates, when their preferred candidate is speaking, that's who they actively listen to. The second the floor is given to the opposing candidate, it's almost like if they change the station in their mind and that candidate suddenly becomes white noise for 2 minutes until they finish. And then when the moderator passes the floor back to their favored candidate, they change the station back to the clear signal and they're actively listening again and they're internalizing everything the candidate is saying. The last concept I'll throw at you in regards to how we process information is motivated reasoning, which goes really hand in hand with selective perception. Motivated reasoning is the idea that we as human beings are much more willing to accept the logic and the reasoning of arguments that we already agree with. Arguments that aren't necessarily convincing us of anything because we have already come to those same conclusions. Whereas when we're analyzing an argument that somebody on the other side is making, somebody who does not look like us and think like us and is coming to a very different conclusion based on the same information, we tend to see their arguments as weak. We tend to not see and appreciate the reasoning and the logic that goes into their arguments as well. Their argument might be even more logical and reasoned and based on actual fact and science than the argument that our side is making, and yet we see our side's argument as stronger. So hopefully these four concepts, cognitive dissonance, confirmation bias, selective perception, and motivated reasoning, can help you think more critically about how you consume and process information, particularly political information, and be a more conscious consumer of knowledge in general. I want to take some time today to talk about human security. Human security is a whole branch, a whole subfield of international relations that has emerged. It came out of the 1994 Human Development Report that was put out by the United Nations Development Programme, and it provided an alternative paradigm for us to think about what we consider national security. So here's the argument. After World War II, the concept of the nation state became formalized. Prior to World War II, countries didn't necessarily exist in the legal sense that they exist today. Now they are legal entities based in international law. And to prevent the atrocities of World War from happening again, these nation states came together and they put all of their emphasis on national security. So we think of security in terms of military defense. It's all about defending and protecting the borders of your now legal nation state from other nation states threatening you. So we dumped tons of money into the military, we dumped tons of money into protecting borders from external threats, and human security kind of comes in and challenges that. Does it matter how strong militarily you are and how well defended your borders are from external threats if internally your people are dying? Why does it matter if somebody invades you or not, if your own people are already suffering and dying at the hands of your own policies? So it kind of took the ownership and put it back onto nation-state governments and how they treat their own citizens and people within their own borders. Are you really secure as a country if your citizens are not secure, right? And I think in the pandemic, it could not be clearer that many countries do not have human security, or they suffer from human insecurity. Because if you live in a very capitalist industrialized country like the United States, where it's all about pull yourselves up by your bootstraps, work hard, and you will have and achieve everything that you need in order to survive and be happy. When crisis hits, the pandemic, a hurricane, a earthquake, people's houses in California being burned down by wildfires, where is the government to protect you? Where is the government to take care of you through that dark period when you've lost everything, when everything you worked so hard for is suddenly gone, it's evaporated, it's vanished, because anything could be taken away from you? My father always told me anything could be taken away from you except your education. So human security is really putting the onus back onto the state and pointing out these huge gaps in services, basic public goods and utilities that people need in order to survive. The basic things that all human beings need to survive is not available to the majority of the population. That is a very insecure population. So yes, we can keep investing a lot of resources into our borders, into protecting ourselves from external threats. But if the threat is internal, then what happens then? So how does race fit into this notion of human security and human insecurity? There's some really fascinating research done by Jonathan Metzl. He wrote a book called Dying of Whiteness: How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Let me try and explain his argument a little bit. Metzl is arguing that because we have so much human insecurity in this country, because we have such a huge lack of public services and social services to make human life secure and make human happiness in general secure, that even white people are suffering and dying. The same basic public goods that minorities, people of color, the LGBTQ community, immigrants, Native Americans, the same basic services they need and are demanding from the government are the same ones that underprivileged and poor white people need to survive as well. White people that do not have a massive inheritance and do not have generations of wealth and land and property passed down to them. White people that aren't legacy kids and don't have a secure spot at Harvard and Stanford, they are living under the same conditions as racial minorities. The root of racial inequality in this country is economic inequality. It's all about poverty. Poverty does kill. If you can't afford to pay for healthcare out of pocket, you will die. If you can't afford to buy enough food to feed yourself and your children and your family on your own because food has become so expensive where you live, you will die. This is what human security is all about. And racism and poverty and inequality is all tied up in that conversation. At some point, rich and powerful white people in this country have to answer to poor and underprivileged white people too. Where were you? What have you been doing to help me? Your own people, your own skin folk. So how could racism really be about race then? If you aren't even creating a sense of equality within the race, then some of the dynamics are at play. Money and privilege and power speaks more than skin color. And if you have the power and the privilege, then you could care less what happens to people within your own community that don't. They don't matter to you any more than the people who don't look like you and the people that don't have the same values that you have. So if racism is really about race, if white supremacy is really about whites being superior to people of color and all other minorities, then at the very least, all white people would be equal in society, which is not the case. So I just want to encourage those in the power majority, those that have all of the privilege of their skin color and of history behind them. How are you treating your own? How are you treating your own neighbors? How are you treating a perfect stranger within your own community? Is that perfect stranger accepted? Do they see themselves as equal? Do you see them as equal? And what went wrong there? And when you can figure out what went wrong within your own community is only when you can begin to address these broader societal problems of inequality and poverty and sexism and racism and human insecurity and everything that I threw at you guys today. So thanks for hanging with me and allowing me the space to navigate what's been on my mind lately. Please go vote. You can log on to iwillvote.org to get tons of information about how to vote in your state and your area and what the options are given the pandemic for voting. Please do not let this very important window pass and let the future be decided by anyone other than you, because you do have a choice. And while you have the privilege to express that choice and make it clear, please take advantage of it. If not for you, for those who don't have a voice and don't share that same access to political rights. This is Christoph Kisoon, and you've been listening to Navigating Diversity. Join us next week at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday as we continue to explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. For more information on all episodes, visit kisu.org/programs/navigatingdiversity.